Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Tim, I don't know about you, but I feel like disaster has been everywhere.
Apocalyptic.
The past couple years, right?
Yeah. No, it really has.
Global pandemic, wildfires, Russian invasion of Ukraine. It's all over the place. And our next guest wants to help us prepare for that. He's the founder of an AI nonprofit that's focused on disaster preparedness. And he joins us now to discuss the product and, of course, the AI space, because we got to talk about that. Phil, great to speak with you. Phil Siebel joining us on Zoom here. Siegel, the founder of CAPTR, Center for Advanced Preparedness and Threat Response Simulation. Phil, thanks again for coming on. Start by just telling us a little bit about what your AI does.
So what we are is the intersection of artificial intelligence and gaming, wargaming. The basic idea is to better prepare, we need to create a set of threats that are plausible, that we, some of which we've experienced, some of which we haven't experienced, and then run them through simulation games to train our crisis management personnel and our politicians and decision makers to make better decisions. And I think, you know, we could say, you know, with a lot of the types of crises we've had over the last several years, you know, maybe we have a fair amount of room for improvement. We use artificial intelligence both to generate these scenarios and also to help the quote-unquote players in the game make better decisions.
What are some of the games that you've simulated?
Yeah, so we've done, we created a new virus and ran a game with the Rockefeller Foundation.
Like a real virus, not a computer virus. We're talking like an actual, you know, COVID-like virus?
Yes. Yes, it wasn't COVID-like. It had a very different characteristic. It came from livestock in the U.S., which is actually quite common, but it had very different characteristics. And we asked scientists to figure out what was going on and whether or not it was going to be a high, medium, or low threat to a regional population. We've created a game actually for City of Austin emergency management personnel to see how well the different departments that are supposed to respond to a threat like this would respond. And we're building games right now for scientists who are members of a group at the New York Academy of Sciences. So we're building a lot of games. We're using artificial intelligence to, you know, really come up with some creative scenarios, but plausible scenarios. And that's, you know, what we're seeing is that with more practice, just like pilots with a flight simulator, people do a better job when they practice.
All right. So obviously you are part of the AI bucket that we have become obsessed with in the first half of this year. So I do want to get your take on the space while we have you, because it's seen so much attention. And I have to wonder if the fundamentals back up some of the prices that we've seen for these big names like the NVIDIAs of the world. What is your calculation and your thinking when it comes to the AI rally that we've seen, and which of these names are going to continue to make it?
Yeah. So in my day job, I'm a private equity manager. So I think that, you know, the old adage of picks and shovels kind of win in the early days is probably fairly true here. I think that I don't know whether you would say NVIDIA is overpriced, but I would say that having it run up, given it's the by far leader in the chip space, which is the ultimate pick and shovel here, makes a lot of sense. There's other, you know, products like that, or there's other pieces like their supply chain. You've seen a lot of run up in those stocks as well. And, you know, we know those are going to benefit from what we're doing. Once you get past that, it gets a little murkier. I don't think we yet know whether the producers of the large language models, the ones that have made the big splash, are going to have viable business models yet. We haven't seen that. In fact, it's not clear to me whether the large language model makers are going to be the winners, or people who are experts at helping companies do small language models are going to be the winners in the space. So there's still a lot of uncertainty and cloudiness, I think, for the next several years.
Well, Phil, as you mentioned, your day job is in private equity. You've been an investor in private companies, venture-backed companies. You've been a professor. You were at BCG as a managing director and partner for many years. Where does your passion for AI come from, and for trying to create an organization that helps with disaster preparedness?
Yeah, so I volunteered during the pandemic to work with BCG on helping some of their government clients respond to the COVID emergency, and saw through that work that we have a lot of opportunity to practice. You know, again, I kind of thought about the analogy of when you get on an airplane, if you heard that your pilot hadn't been in a flight simulator, you'd be pretty alarmed. Yet, you know, with a lot of our disaster preparedness and crisis management, we aren't doing that type of work every year. We do, you know, obviously this group of people is highly educated and hardworking, but I would like to see them every year spending time honing their skills so that they're more ready and better. And that was really what caused me to want to co-found this this NGO, if you will, or nonprofit.
Well, where does the AI come from? And are you at all concerned about AI in the sense of it being a threat to humanity?
Yeah, I that's two very different questions. So I'll focus on the second. I'm less worried about you know, the scenarios we see in the movies like iRobot or Terminator 2, where the AI becomes sentient and on its own decides it's going to destroy humanity. I am very worried that bad actors are going to use these technologies and are already using these technologies to do bad acts.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to be protecting against in the short term.
Yeah. 30 seconds, Phil. Who are some of the companies and names that should not be jumping on AI and investing heavily into the AI space?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I'm not 100% sure how to answer it, other than to say I think there are some sectors where they really need to be thinking about, especially capital intensive sectors, where if they change the basic business model through investing in AI, they can lower the barriers to entry. They might have new entrants come in, whether it's the mining and exploration industry and so forth. You don't want to bring in new entrants that you don't have to. But on the other hand, you need to lower your operating costs. And right. So it's a race.
And it's all about capital allocation at the end of the day. Phil, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to have to bring you back on. Phil Siegel, founder of CAPTRS, that's the Center for Advanced Preparedness and Threat Response Simulation, among many other resume lines.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
First, we're going to put our economist hats on.
Ooh,
Tim.
I really brought mine today.
Did you?
I did, yeah.
I took it on the train with me. Here's the thing. A simple economics rule that helps us suss out whether the U.S. is in a recession. It's getting called into question by its own creator. It's called the SOM rule, and its architects, the architect rather, is worried that her creation has become a monster. That's the headline of the Business Week story we're focusing on today, which you can find on the terminal and, of course, at Bloomberg.com. Here to discuss the breakdown with us is Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber and the reporter on this story, Enda Curran. Joel, what's up with this
it's,
rule?
It's all Enda. Did you describe this as a simple economic rule?
Enda, the word is, simple is used in the story.
Such a thing? I just want to clarify. Is there such a thing?
I won't pretend it's simple. I won't pretend I even fully understand the mechanics of it. So that's a brave call.
Okay. All right. So what
that
is...
That makes me feel better, Enda. Makes me feel better.
I honestly had never heard of the SOM rule. So break it down for us and what what everybody's talking about here.
Well, so look, Claudia Sam, first of all, she's a very accomplished economist. She had a long career at the Fed. She had a stint in the White House as well. And at her time at the Fed in 2019, she published this rule or this measure, which essentially looks for increases in unemployment in a real-time way and looks for the increase relative to the 3-month average compared to the low point of the year before. Point being, it's a real-time way to gauge, oh, look, the job market might be turning, jobs are being lost. And the second part of it is that's a warning sign to governments, or the U.S. government in particular, that we're in a recession, so it's time to start getting money out to those who need it fast. So that's the key point about it. It's a real-time gauge. It looks at the labor market, and that's much faster than the current system of gauging when there's a recession, which is an 8-member committee that come together and often don't diagnose it until a year after the event.
So how did she create a monster? Because that's the fun part.
Exactly, yeah. So the issue here is that it's got two things. First of all, people are kind of talking about it in the sense of forecasting this much vaunted U.S. recession, will it, won't it? And her point is it's not a tool for forecasting recessions. It's an indicator to say when we're in a recession. And the second point of it is it's just got tied up in this whole broader tug of war of will the U.S. fall into recession? Will it not? What's the SAM rule telling us? When her point is that this was meant to be an indicator that, look, people are losing their jobs and the governments need to get money out straight away because that mitigates, offsets whatever damage a recession might be coming. So she just feels that it's getting caught up in the maelstrom of this whole soft landing debate.
Well, she said to you, the whole point of it was, okay, we need to get people help because if you can get in at the beginning of a recession, you can do so much to soften the blow. The issue is the consumer has been so resilient. The American consumer has been so resilient. So
yeah.
This has been pretty humbling, not just for her, but for so many economists.
Yeah. So in terms of, the rule itself, this policy advice that she was giving, say, pre-pandemic. Ultimately, it's what the Trump administration did, is that when people started losing their jobs, they put money into people's households to offset the worst of the recession. So it kind of did follow the policy prognosis. But you're right. The real crux of this is where we are now. You know, the job market's softening somewhat. There's a lot of talk that the economy will soften. But Claudia Sam is making the point that, look, if unemployment was to go up somewhat, and, you know, mechanically trigger her rule that suggests it's passing a threshold that the economy might be going into recession. So if the jobless rate was to go up, but the actual economy doesn't go into recession, she'll be fine with that. She doesn't mind if her rule is proven, is tested, so to speak, or even proven to be inaccurate on this occasion, as long as it means the US pulls off a soft landing. And she's in the camp that there doesn't need to be a recession to bring down inflation at the moment. She thinks inflation's on a glide path lower. You don't need to blow up the jobs market. She said it's still possible that it happens, but she thinks it's a path for soft landing. And that's her whole point about it. If her rule is proven wrong this time, that the jobless rate goes up a touch, but there is no recession, she'll be fine with that.
She also just sounds funny to me. She said that she created a monster. She said she was surprised she ended up at the Fed, even though she's obviously a genius and created this rule. She would love to see this break. What were your impressions of her?
Claudia's very accomplished economist. Like you just mentioned, a long career in the public sector, a lot of academic research, PhD from Michigan. She has a proven track record behind her. Claudia also was on the front line of pushing for the diversity debate at the Fed when she was there. We spoke a lot about that. She said the institution has come a long way compared to the time she was there. And of course, we got into the world of social media, because that's also a big part of the story, that the economic debate has moved from, say, the halls of universities and maybe the opinion pages of newspapers into this real-time back and forward sort of punch bowl on Twitter, etc.
Yeah,
and
Claudia herself, Tim's like, thinks he knows what he's talking about.
I know.
It's like, that's when you know we've got a problem.
Just wait till the Stenovec rule, Joel. All right? Just wait until that happens.
Stenovec rule's called Friday at 5 and I'm out of here. Yeah.
Six.
Oh, six. Sorry.
But Enda, you bring up a really good point, because she's huge on Twitter. And I must confess, I have taken a break from Twitter lately, but
it's X, but yeah,
whatever it's X. called. She's and she writes for Bloomberg Opinion. I mean, she's out there.
She used to be very out there as well, very vocal. I mean, she wrote a blog post in 2020 that was highly critical of some very senior peers in the economics field, and she named them. So that caused a big stir at the time. And, you know, she was on the front edge of a lot of sharp exchanges on Twitter as well. But, you know, Claudia has pulled back from Twitter. She made that point. She took a couple of months off of it. She's back on it now just to publish her research. She's not interested in getting involved in the back and forward, the hot take debates. In fact, she said she stays off Twitter on hot take days. So hot take day will obviously be the jobs day on Friday, right? So she's steering well clear of that.
She's got all these rules. I want to know the rest of the rules, actually. Okay, so, Enda, you write that if she get it right and economics textbooks will be rewritten, get it wrong and the credibility of central bank will be damaged and the U.S. economy doomed to stagflation. Which way is it trending so far, and when will we know? We got to, you know, textbooks require some, you know, forward planning.
Right here, right now, there's this window that the U.S. can pull this off, that they can get inflation down, the data has been heading in the right direction, inflation's coming off, and maybe they can navigate some sort of a soft landing without the kind of massive recession that some people were warning about. Now, if that happens, that puts Jerome Powell in the Hall of Legends, up there with Volcker in terms of global central bankers who pulled off the impossible. But there are a lot of people who push back and say it's too soon to say mission accomplished. We don't yet know what the full impact of these rate hikes will be. We don't yet know if inflation is going to come all the way back down to where it should be. And people on the street are feeling the impact of these price rises over the past few years. So there's another camp out there saying hang tight for another 6 months or so and see where we are then.
Wait, you just invoked Volcker. I'm actually curious. If Powell pulls this off, who becomes more of a legend, Volcker or Powell?
It's an interesting question. I think if Powell pulled this off, it would be seen to be quite a feat, because there's a backstory. You could say, hang on, central banks missed how all this inflation was building up anyway. But when they went very hard. The Fed were doing all those massive rate hikes, 75 basis points at a time. A lot of people being very critical. You're going to blow up the economy. You don't need to do this. And if they do pull this off and get inflation down on a glide path, it looks like, you know, would put the US in pretty good order compared to some of its peers around the world, compared to what's going on in Europe, for example. And I think Powell then would maybe take something of a victory lap. But as
I would,
I say,
I would just retire. Just like, I'm done.
I think Joel brings up a good point, Enda. I mean, because, you know, Volcker had to raise rates to, what, close to 20% in the early 1980s. And if Powell pulls this off with rates around 5%?
And unemployment went to 11%.
Yeah.
Under Volcker and you know, under Powell, unemployment fell to 3.4% in February, which was the lowest since 1969. So they're fairly different circumstances. Maybe we're seeing the birth of the Powell rule here. We don't yet know.
Did you just coin that? That's good. So original. I fear that I just jinxed everything.
Oh, yeah. Great. Joel crash landing.
Oh, man.
Weber.
I would love for you to be the leading indicator of our economy, Joel.
Just, you know, there are some people on Twitter, X, who have written how the Business Week covers are, you know, that's...
Really?
Yes.
I don't know about this. Can you explain it?
Once we talk about it, it means it's late. And everything
rude. Goes
the wrong like way. Once you have the R word on the cover.
I will brought say, down the dollar. The dollar was very strong, and then we did the cover story, and it was less strong.
I will push back on that. I think it's like there's no perfect record here, but there's like you know there's a couple prominent ones.
Yeah,
but,
we get you know every once in a while. We hold
I look
up.
At you as like an oracle, Joel.
I'll take it. Speaking of oracles, can we talk about Enda some more? Because he was busy this week and he wrote about Barbie.
I was hoping we would go there, Joel.
Yeah, you know, let's just stay with cool things. Like, I mean, Somerville's pretty cool. You didn't know about that, but maybe you knew about Barbie. Tell us about what you wrote for today's newsletter, Enda.
Yeah, so the toy industry has been in a bit of a slowdown this year because, you know, it's coming off the highs of the pandemic when people were buying so much of that stuff. This year, stores have been running down their inventory, less buying of toys, especially from Asia, of course. So I touched base with a couple of manufacturers and said, how are things looking? And one of those I spoke to, he's one of the biggest makers of toy dinosaurs in the world. And he said he can't wait for this year to be over. So the thinking is that the Barbie effect might give all boats a lift. I mean, Mattel themselves are talking about they're expecting a lift from the Barbie chain of products. And of course, there's a thinking that that might get people back into toy stores and spending money on other products too. And that's what this toy maker that I spoke to, he's making the point that he's hoping for a lift towards the end of the year, because certainly buying toys hasn't been on everyone's shopping list so far in 2023.
Wait a second. Did you say the world's biggest manufacturer of dinosaurs?
One of the biggest, yeah. And he also makes Chattimal the talking hamster. He's got a ranked product.
We've got questions about that, but let's stay with dinosaurs. So the dinosaur business is difficult right now?
Well, so he makes and sells for some of the biggest brands in the US. And his point was that a lot of these stores have built up inventory. They bought so much back during the pandemic because they wanted to get ahead of supply chain problems and everything else. They needed to just get the stock in. But now, of course, they have to run down through all of that stock. So his order book hasn't been good this year. That was the point he was making. But he's hoping that it will turn now towards the end of the year with reports that inventories are being run down. And, of course, the U.S. consumer is holding up stronger than expected. Throw a bit of Barbie magic, a bit of Barbie sprinkle on top of that, and maybe people might start splashing their plastic again on toys this year.
Okay, what was the hamster thing? I've never...
He also has a talking hamster, which he makes. He makes all of this out in East Asia. It's an old contact of mine, but he sells it to Europe and the US. And one of his products is a talking hamster.
Is this what? Like, is this remember Tickle Me Elmo, Joel? Like, is this that's a throwback?
Tickle Me Hamster.
Is this like a? Is this going to be like what everyone wants for the holidays?
I love the arbitrage. Make this in Asia. Sell your talking hamster to Europe. Don't do it in the US.
Don't.
The European big market though.
Brutal.
So the idea here. Enda, is that people are going to say, okay, well, Barbie's so hot right now. We're going to add Barbie to our shopping list for the holidays. And while we're at the toy store, while we're on, I don't know why I even say toy store, while we're online, we're going to add some other toys, some G.I. Joes, some talking hamsters, and some dinosaurs to our cart.
That's certainly the dinosaurs and Barbie seamless, but that's certainly the hope among a couple of manufacturers that I spoke to.
Well,
I wonder if it materializes.
Mattel's biggest product sales, as you know, Enda, is it's Hot Wheels. It's not Barbie. Right?
Yeah. But they were saying in their earnings report last week that they are hoping for pickup from Barbie. They do see some increase in the second half of the year.
Buy the Barbie, you buy the Hot Wheel to go with it.
Yeah.
Also, it's really IP And that was, you know,
exactly
what the Barbie cover story in Bloomberg Business Week was about.
Yep.
Perhaps a leading indicator of the toy economy. We'll find out more in the weeks and months ahead.
And when we get the Super Mario Brothers movie expected in 2025,
it'll get moved forward because everybody wants more Mario.
Right.
Shout out to Enda. Two stories in one episode right now, one segment that we've talked about. Amazingly, he has more content in the magazine. Like, he's a busy guy, but we're not even going to talk about that one. Maybe we'll do another segment about it later.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, it's only Tuesday. So, Enda, we'll you got to come back. God, it's good to have you busy with us this afternoon. And also, Joel, always great to have you. That voice you're hearing, Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber, and also Bloomberg Global Economy reporter Enda Curran, talking about the SOM rule and Barbie. Only we can marry, you know, Barbie and an economic
rule. That was a really good transition, Joel.
Thank you, Joel.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
For the past 3 years, something has happened in my home state of California that has never happened before. It's lost population. More than 500,000 residents have fled, relocating to cheaper locales like Texas and Arizona. But despite what you may have heard from some high-profile venture capitalists, it's not the wealthy who are leaving. It's not the wealthy who are struggling. In fact, the wealthy are doing really well. They're flourishing in California. This year through July, California's billionaires added $270 billion in wealth. That's according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index. It tracks more billionaires in the state than in any country except for China. Biz Carson is Bloomberg News wealth reporter. She wrote that story. She joins us this afternoon from San Francisco, from our bureau in San Francisco. Biz, good to have you with us. You've lived in California for a while, haven't you?
Yeah, it's 10 years now in California, so that's quite some time.
So how is the narrative where you've been in Silicon Valley, how has it shifted? And what made you want to explore this story?
Well, I think there's been a big shift in California. I don't think you can deny, you know, there has been a historic population loss in the state. But the last 10 years have been a huge time of wealth generation, particularly in Silicon Valley. You've seen it in Hollywood. The state is richer than ever. And so when we got our hands on some tax data from the state of California, we realized it was something new to me, just the record number of millionaires that had been created in over the pandemic time period. And it's a wealth creation that we haven't seen before in the state.
And I wonder, too, why we're not seeing more of the Ken Griffin movement, I guess. Why aren't we seeing some of the wealthiest people say, I don't want to pay the taxes to be here anymore?
We've seen a few people like Elon Musk and Larry Ellison, I think, are the two biggest names to say we're leaving. But a lot of people are staying, but it's not necessarily something that they're bragging about, like, oh, I love paying my higher taxes. I'm so excited to stay in California these days. Like, it's just not part of the conversation. It's more part of the conversation when you're looking at the weather and it's beautiful 70 degrees compared to the rest of the country.
Hey, way to rub it in.
Yeah, I know.
It's always it's beautiful.
I'd wear a jacket today. It was very cold. and so you're not seeing kind of this, you know, you're seeing it from a handful of people who are beating the drum saying California's time to go. But the people who are staying here, the people who are getting even richer, you know, don't have as loud of a voice. And I think that was kind of the counter narrative we found in this data, is to say, wait, there's more millionaires here than ever, even if you think that everyone's up and left.
It's wild, this data that you got your hands on, Biz. I'm going to read right from your story, okay? In total, more than 288,000 Californians, or 0.7% of residents, so that's close to 1% of residents, reported over $1 million in income in 2021. So you almost have one in every 100 people in 2021 getting $1 million in income. The thing that's
that's income. You
that's
know, it's
income.
Not just, oh, I own a house that's worth $1 million. We're talking income that they're reporting on their taxes.
That's,
and the caveat is
that what's the caveat here?
Yeah, it's typically where we think it's an underestimation of the millionaires, because a lot of people, when they get to a certain level of wealth, you know, they're reducing their personal income tax burden and shifting around, taking out debt, other things. So we think it's likely higher. But this is the bare minimum of what we know who's reporting $1 million or more in income.
The flip side of this, though, is the affordability crisis in California. And what you do note in your story is that the people who have left have left for places that are less expensive because they found affordability challenging in California. It's really hard to afford a house there. There are no starter homes in California. What's going on?
Absolutely. I think these go hand in hand, right? We saw this record number of millionaires being created, but California also became a more unequal state. It moved up in the Gini coefficient, which is a measure of inequality in the state. And so we've seen the state become more unequal, you know, partially as a result of this wealth. And only one in five people in California right now can afford the median home price of $800,000. So we can't, you know, this data shows an exorbitant amount of wealth, but with that, you are creating inequality. It does become harder to live here. You know, the rich can buy up the houses, leaving everyone else struggling. And we see that now playing out in some of these labor strikes in Hollywood. Fast forwarding to 2023, labor is a huge issue. Inflation's been hard. So this wealth is true. It's created a ton, but it kind of exacerbates the problems in the state as well.
That's really interesting, because that makes me wonder whether that is going to be the headwind for California or if it's going to be something else. What do you think is the single biggest thing that could change this dynamic that we're seeing of the ultra wealthy continuing to stay there?
That's a great question. It's not necessarily taxes. That was something that was surprising to us. And, you know, as we reported this story, taxing the rich doesn't necessarily have any effect in California specifically on them moving out of the state. So we can't just say, well, we'll tax them and, you know, decrease their wealth and, you know, everything will be fixed. That's not going to happen. What could fix California? That is a question way above my pay grade, and I have no idea. It's a challenging state. There's a lot of people here, a lot of economic inequality. And we'll see, you know, what kind of the pressure of these labor strikes, you know, how the government responds, things like that, will, what that will do to the state. So that's kind of an open question.
Yeah. I'm wondering too about the politics there, and this isn't a politics story per se, but it's everything is political, as they say. So I wonder to what extent, you know, these wealthy people are controlling or trying to control the politics in the state. We saw some high profile recalls in San Francisco. We've seen a mayoral race that's backed by some very wealthy people in the city. What can you tell us about their role in politics?
I think the wealthy have always had an outsized role in politics just due to be able to bankrolling it. You know, that's not unique to California necessarily. I think, you know, given we have more wealth in the state, will we see something happening in the election coming up? I don't know. I think that's going to be an interesting question. You know, will this shift any part of the voter base? I don't know. The one interesting part of this data is California's reliance on personal income tax and this 1% bracket. Because of the tax system, it relies on the top 1% of earners, roughly 50% of the personal income tax revenue. So anything that does happen to the incomes of these top earners has real effects on the state's budget. And so I think that is kind of almost a bigger political question of if these top earners start losing money, if the economy swings in a bad direction, yeah, that's going to have bigger political ramifications, I think, for the state than necessarily, you know, wealthy millionaires donating to local political campaigns.
Biz, I want to end with your lead on this story. It sets the scene with a party for the core club. It's members only club. It opens next year for Californians who are ready to shell out $15,000 to $100,000 in initiation fees. Just describe to me the vibe there or in Silicon Valley right now at a time when, you know, people have said that California and Silicon Valley just feel different.
They do feel different, but there's still, you know, it's still some great times here. The AI boom is centered in California right now. This party happened at the Transamerica Pyramid, which is undergoing this $1 billion renovation, and a New York developer bought the building and is renovating it. It's going to be this big $1 billion project. So there's still investment, there's still excitement in California, but it's been tempered a little bit. I think the last few years have been hard, particularly in the San Francisco downtown. We've seen with office spaces. So there's a bit of a vibe shift, but people are still, you know, able to sip cocktails and champagne and pass appetizers on the 36th floor and, you know, be happy with their lives.
Does it still seem like more? Does it still seem like San Francisco is as empty as it was during the pandemic, or are people actually going back to work? They're taking the shuttles south.
the downtown core, I'd say, is still somewhat empty, you know, when you're talking Union Square, Civic Center, but the neighborhoods are flourishing. I took the F train today down Market Street to the Bloomberg office, and it was packed with people and tourists. So there is a liveliness to the city. It's just not quite the same energy of, you know, all the tech workers with their matching backpacks, yeah, you know, flooding Montgomery Street. That has gone. The lines for lunch are a little shorter than they used to be. So I may not complain about that. But, you know, there is a bit of a vibe shift.
Biz, Carson, it is good to have you on the program today. And, you know, I got to say, Maddie, I may be biased here, but I'm certainly rooting for California. And, of course, every state here in the U.S. But California is a special place.
We're not biased.
In my heart. We're not biased.
We have no opinions or thoughts on states.
Biz Carson is Bloomberg News wealth reporter joining us from our San Francisco bureau. Thanks so much, Biz. Appreciate it.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving, stay in crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week, and, you know, let's get a quick check of the markets. We haven't checked in on those in a while. The Dow, up about 0.1%. The S&P 500 down 0.3%. The NASDAQ down 0.4%. Well, Maddie, the stock rally that's taken a little bit of a breather has, you know what? It's lost a little bit of steam in the last couple of days. I got to tell you, the S&P 500 up 19%. This year in August, it's nothing to shake a stick at. We do get a mixed bag of corporate earnings and economic data that's leaving markets a little bit meh today. But we got a great guest here to make sense of it all.
Yeah, I'm very excited about getting someone to help me make sense of all of the movement that we're seeing here. For our Drive to the Close, we've got Christopher Tsai on, President and CEO at Tsai Capital. Christopher, it's so great to speak with you, and thanks for coming in here. We're talking about the meh trade here today. What would you say is the single biggest thing kind of driving this trade? Is it investors sort of taking on some profits, and that's why we're seeing a little bit less green on the screen here? Or is it kind of just a mixed reaction to the eco data?
I mean, we've had an incredible run this year in all of the major indexes. But what we try to do really at Tsai Capital is focus on the long term. So we really don't pay much attention to the everyday noise that is circling the markets.
Well, what would you consider everyday noise versus what you do pay attention to?
Well, we have now a 23-year track record, and we've gone through so many different environments with noise such as inflation concerns, recession concerns. We've navigated through the Asian financial crisis, the dot-com bubble, et cetera, et cetera. And there's never been really that much of great news to look at. So what we try to do is focus on the long term and focus on the individual fundamentals of the companies that we're investing in. And it's just to us nonsensical to forego investing in a business that has a predictable long-term future because of short-term concerns about the market or the economy that are inherently unpredictable.
So what does that calculation look like when it comes to the fundamentals?
Well, we think that the fundamentals for many companies are actually quite strong. And our focus is really to look at the strongest of the strong, to focus on the high quality businesses that we think have great futures, that are growing rapidly, and to take advantage of market weakness. Your previous guest spoke about coming out of this environment, playing offense. And we think about that kind of strategy as well. So in other words, when we have a bear market like we recently had, we've played a little offense. We added a number of companies to the portfolios that we think have great futures that have asymmetry in the potential returns. So that's what we're trying to do, provide diversification for our investors, but also to provide some offense coming out of a recession.
What are some of those companies that you've recently added to?
Yes, we added to a company called MSCI, which is a leader in data analytics. It's a company that is really integral to many money management firms and financial service organizations. We also bought a company called Zoetis, which is a leading manufacturer of pharmaceuticals for the livestock and poultry industries.
I'm going to totally switch gears here, you guys. I hope that's okay. I'm realizing in your guest note that you talk about your grandmother, Ruth Tsai, was the first woman to trade shares on the floor of the Shanghai Stock Exchange. That is so cool. Do you have any investment lessons that have been passed down to you, both from her and from your father, of course, as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. I appreciate that question because my late father has been in the press so many times, but my grandmother, Ruth, was really a pioneer for women in China at her time. So as you've mentioned, she was the first woman to trade on the floor of the Shanghai Stock Exchange from around 1939 to 1941. And she passed on so many wonderful lessons to my father, and my father passed on so many wonderful lessons to me. So I'm really a third generation investor. My grandmother Ruth had a saying, when the tide goes out 10 feet, a large ship and a small boat both go out 10 feet. I think that was her way of really thinking about bear markets and how to deal with bear markets.
I love that. Hey, just in the last 30 seconds that we have with you, if somebody brings new money to you right now and they have a long-term horizon, how are you deploying it?
That's also an amazing question because we always find that deploying capital is a lot harder than learning how to sell a company. So what we try to do is we try to scale into our scale in new capital. So we typically invest around 2/3 up front, and then we try to deploy the rest of the third in a relatively short period of time. What we're trying to get away from is timing the market. Clients come with us with a long-term philosophy, so we're not trying to time 1 month or 2 months, but we do like to scale into a degree.
Christopher Tsai, President and CIO at Tsai Capital, joining us this afternoon on Zoom. Really appreciate you taking the time to join us right here on Bloomberg Business Week. And this is Bloomberg.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, We don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.